music, and love, where your stories are told in unison. The most loving words that we can say, and we say it so bold. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston. Welcome home.
Clouds below your knees signals that it is 8 p.m. on Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. Tonight we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls and transport us to a montage of magical worlds before returning us safely to the present right back here at KPFT station. Hi, I'm Harwood Taylor, gallery director at Grimion and Company Fine Art, and I am super excited to be here tonight co-hosting the show along with my good friend Chris Gorman. We really love this show, and Dr. Hank asking us to be here tonight is an honor and a guaranteed good time. We would also like to tip our collective hats to our fellow host, Greg Audell, who's in the station tonight, okay. Warren Holloman, Paul Tipkian, I'm not saying that right, Mary Edgerton, Eric Keen, and the entire So What's Your Story team. We are here tonight in the KPFT studio, very pleased to welcome friend of the show and our great friend, Michael Galco, and our very own Dr. Hank Rubichek for an exciting night.
Wait a minute. Justin, over there in the booth. I'm getting a lot of interference in my microphone. What's going on? What's the frequency, Justin? Something's coming through.
I don't know.
Everyone what is
has
that?
A story to tell. It's a tradition as old as time. Wimberley's first storytelling fest invites you to come, listen, laugh, and learn. Look at us. We're bringing storytellers in from all over Texas. Houston, Austin, San Antonio, and the Hill Country, too. Famous tellers, award-winning PBSers, indigenous elders, and local jawboners. We'll see you at 7A Ranch Opera House on 2/22/2020.
2/22/2020. The Storytelling Festival in beautiful Wimberley.
Woohoo! That's so much
fun. Oh, you guessed it. It's Throwback Thursday, and we are bringing to the show an exciting surprise. A few weeks ago, we attended the first annual Wimberley Storytelling Festival, and we enjoyed it very much. We wished we could have brought y'all with us. The venue was very charming, but there's no way we could have fit all of you listeners inside, so we brought back some souvenirs. Great tales featured at the festival, told by the storytellers themselves. So tonight, just sit back, relax, and go on a road trip with us as we share with all of you the magical time that we had at the Wimberley Storytelling Festival.
All right, road trip.
Road trip. It's Thursday night, and so what's your story time? Wimberley Storytelling Festival Rewind.
All right.
Harwood, could you fill us in on how this festival even became a thing?
Okay, so this is really amazing. Many, many years ago, a friend invited me. Let's see, how did that work?
Well, it was interesting because you had told a story.
That's right.
And you had a friend that you ran into. It was a story that included your mentor.
That's right.
Yes.
Richard Payne.
Yes.
And so Richard Payne was a very famous architectural photographer in town. And I hadn't talked to him in a long time. And we were asked to be on the show. And I really didn't have a story. And I started thinking about Richard Payne. And I just remembered him being very influential about how I looked at the world in general. And I told a story about him that was on So What's Your Story? Maybe a year goes by. I don't think about it. And I saw a woman that I met through Richard Payne. And I said, God, you know, I told a story a year ago about Richard. Do you want to hear it? I played it for her. And she goes, has Richard heard that? And I said, no, he hadn't. And she said, he'd really love to hear that. And I said, yeah, I've been meaning to do that. And just, you know, a year went by. And she said, you need to call him right now. He's very sick. So I called him right away. I went over to his house. I probably intended on spending an hour. I spent about 4 hours because I realized it'd be one of the last days I got to see Richard. And then time goes by, about a year. Richard died. And his wife asked me if I wanted to help curate an exhibition of photography at the Houston Downtown Library. And I was honored and helped several other people curate the show, including their regular curator, who was wonderful. And towards the end of those meetings, someone said, can anybody be the MC? Because Richard did not want to have a funeral. And this is really an honoring ceremony as much as an exhibition of photography of his work. And everybody took a collective step backward. And I was standing there thinking, I do tell stories. Maybe I can do this. So I said, I'll do it. And I loved your dad and I would love to do it. And, but I said, if anybody else knows him better or feels moved to do it, so anyway, she said, no one wants to do it. You're it. So I invited her for coffee right away. Cause I had really didn't know Kathy at all, his daughter. And we're sitting at coffee. She's like, why do you even feel comfortable talking in front of people? She does not like that much. And I said, well, I tell stories and I'm usually very scared when I do it, but I would love to honor your dad. And she goes, you tell stories? We're trying to do a storytelling festival in Wimberley. Would you help us? And I said, I know a bunch of storytellers. I don't know anything about festivals, but I know Dr. Hank, and Hank knows everything about stories and storytelling festivals, or people that know how to do these things. And so for the last 6 months, we planned on having 2/22/2020, and that happened 2 weeks ago, and now we're all here in the studio at KPFT doing a rewind of what happened 2 weeks ago. It was the very first annual, we hope, storytelling festival in beautiful Wimberley.
I know. And Kathy, we got to stay at their house.
We did. She made, Kathy and Robert were awesome.
Kathy and Robert. And Kathy made zucchini bread that was the most delicious zucchini bread I have ever eaten in my life. I ate like
A raft
of bread. And we met their dog, Hank, who is the first dog of Wimberley. She uses him in the chamber for advertising businesses. And
he's super cute. And she would just take him and he'd put on a 4th of July hat or whatever. He's got lots of outfits. He likes to wear shades at the 4th of July parade. There are pictures of him at the Wimberley story. The Wimberley Arts. What is it?
Wivwaka, wasn't it? The Wimberley Wivwaka. Art. Thank
Say
you.
Say that 10 times fast.
Come on, Michael, help me out.
Okay, this is a storytelling show and that story's over.
All right. Well, okay. Harwood, I understand that you, in addition to emceeing the festival, which was a big job, told the first story to open the festival, which is a big deal.
That's true.
And it's a story that I've always loved. It's full of imagination and the power of belief, just like the belief it takes to create an arts event in a community. You have to really put your power behind it to create anything, much less an event where you gather a bunch of people together. Do you want to tell this amazing story from your childhood?
I certainly do.
Please
Thank
do.
You.
Please do.
And a shout out to Chick, who was the PhD and cat herder of the entire committee. There were 7 or 8 people, and I intended fully to get all their names and acknowledge them all. But thank you all for helping put that festival on. It was just a smashing success and so much fun. So mm-hmm. I'm going to take you back. Step way back. I was 12 years old, and my best friend and I, who was a special needs guy. I'm just telling you that so you can imagine, like, there's a place that a special needs person in my experience can go to that is an unbridled kind of joy that that this story engendered in him, and just keep that in mind. So anyway, from zero, I knew Bill, and we were best friends. And he was an incredible athlete. Our two favorite things, though, were the Goodyear blimp and football. And we lived a block away from Rice University. And so every Saturday during football season, the home games would have both football and the Goodyear blimp. The Goodyear blimp was stationed in Houston out in north of I-45, where the Woodlands is now. In any event, I also used to help. I used to always pick Bill on my teams because he was this incredible athlete. One thing he could do was throw a perfect spiral. If anybody's ever tried to throw a football, it's a very weird motion. Very few people can do this. He could throw a football a mile, and I could explain things to him in a way that he understood. And so I always picked him, and we always won and whatever. But as a consequence, he never didn't want to be on my team. I didn't ever want to not have him on my team. And so when it was just the two of us, we wouldn't play one-on-one. We would play this game that he invented called playing the ghosts. And what that amounted to is, so the ball game, the football game's going on over at Rice, and they would announce scores of touchdown. You'd hear the fans and whatever. And we would act that out. We'd hike the ball and score a touchdown. Or, you know, tackled on the 50-yard line, number 59, you know, whatever. We'd hike the ball and throw ourselves into a bush. Well, inevitably, we would hear this. You know what that is? That is the Goodyear blimp. Don't you dare, Chris.
The blimp.
That's what we all did when we were kids. We'd point up into the trees, and over these enormous pecan trees and oak trees would come the blimp. And we'd get on our bikes, and we'd cross Rice University, which was right behind our street, balls over. And it was a game day. Our parents would not have been happy about that because of the traffic. And we would just look at the blimp and ride our bikes and just, I mean, it was a magical thing. It's basically a giant balloon with people inside. It's still cool to this day to think about what a blimp is. How does that work? Anyway, we got little models of the blimp. We got posters of the blimp. And then one day I thought, we need to build a blimp trap. And that's right. You heard me. It's a trap for the blimp. You need very specific things to be able to build a blimp trap. You need to have a 12-year-old's imagination. And you need to have a dad that has a lot of unfinished projects, including four boards, literally four boards, leaned together in the shape of a rectangle, the shape and size of which would fit two 12-year-old boys. I sat in the front. Bill sat in the back. We basically stuck rusty
handlebars.
That's right, handlebars from a bike into the dirt. That's how you drove the blimp trap. And then you had to have grabbers to grab the blimp. And those were enormous dead pecan tree limbs. So Bill would be in the back with the grabbers. All the other technology, which was immense because a blimp trap has a lot of technology, was in our imagination. And we would make sounds and make up words, you know, like, Mr. Slim Boss, and then engage, and then, you know, grabbers. And so the blimp would go around the stadium, it would come around our neighborhood, and it would fly almost exactly over our house on its way over the Rice Stadium. And, you know, we'd grab with the grabbers, Bill would grab with the grabbers, and we almost caught the blimp a lot during football season, until one season my dad was at the press club. My dad was a local journalist. He was a freelance journalist for all the local papers, and he introduced himself to this guy who was the featured guest, who was the, I guess, managed the Goodyear blimp hangar. And he said, I feel like I should give you my card. My name's Bill Taylor, and my son and his best friend have a blimp trap. If the blimp ever goes missing, it's likely in our driveway. And so he said, really? Well, if you'll send me a photograph of the blimp trap, I will get them a ride on the blimp. And my dad didn't tell us this. Maybe he thought the guy wouldn't follow through or whatever. But my dad took a photograph, sent the photograph in the mail, and three tickets came back for me, Bill, and Bill's mom. So we drive out to 45 North. We get to the blimp hangar. There's this amazing glass wall, two-story glass wall that's like the observation room while you're waiting to ride the blimp. There's an enormous hangar that has Goodyear written on the side and these huge doors. And we imagined those doors were going to open, or at least I did, and that the blimp was kind of emerge, but that's not what happened. We heard the blimp. The blimp! that's right. And the pilot had to know what he was doing. He flew right over the top of that glass wall. And if you can remember that Star Wars movie, the very first one, where that enormous ship comes out of the top of the screen and it just keeps coming and coming and coming, that thing was loud. And I'm 12 and I'm like, this is kind of scary. I don't want to ride in the blimp anymore. Anyway, very quickly I got over it. There were six or seven men that held these ropes and they attached the blimp somehow, secured it. It's floating there. We got up inside. There were six or eight seats, I recall. The back of the blimp, the back wall of the cabin of the blimp, had a mural on it, a painting of the history of ballooning and dirigibles. We both got to drive the blimp that day, and I have a very specific memory of just watching Bill drive the blimp. And I mean, it's just the kind of joy that was coming out of Bill was like, I mean, I was almost happier to see him drive the blimp than getting to drive it myself. I also have a specific memory of him spinning this wheel that was between the two front seats. And that wheel controlled the blimp going up and down. The blimp started to go down. If it had been a fighter jet, we would have all died. But it was a very slow, lumbering movement. You know, it was like, brrr, he spins this thing and the blimp, brrr, you know, starts to go down. The captain quickly says, "I'll take it from here, son." And he starts rolling this, you know, wheel back. And so that's the end of the story. At least I thought it was. And then 20 years goes by. I don't think about it. Some people that were visiting the gallery had just gotten back from Atlanta. The Goodyear blimp is no longer in Houston. And they said, "Coolest thing, we got to ride in the Goodyear blimp." So I told them what I just told you. And then I got the giggles. I started laughing. I could not stop laughing. And this guy's like, "What's so funny?" And I said, "I hadn't thought about that in 20 years. And it really never occurred to me. I'm realizing just now that at 12 years old, me and my best friend made a blimp trap. And it worked."
Woohoo! I love that story so much. Me too. That is one of my favorite ones that you tell. It always reminds me that everything is possible. Don't count anything out.
Absolutely. It's just having a vision for something and not knowing how it can happen. You know, I never thought I'd be a storyteller, really. And then the subject for the moth came up, obsession. And I just remember being obsessed with the blimp. And then I told Chris, I'm like, "Okay, I'm ready to tell a story. And it's an amazing story and I'll win." And then I forgot, I didn't realize how scared I would get. I also didn't realize how good Chris was. I got to see her tell a story for the first time. And when I saw her tell a story before I got called, I thought, "Wow, I have nailed second place. I guarantee you." That's exactly what happened. She got first place and I got second place.
He always loves to tell that story, and I have no memory of beating him at that. But I'm glad he does.
Yep.
Because that is
awesome.
I'm a sore
loser.
Yeah, totally. Totally grudgy. I get it. Okay.
Hate you.
Thanks for the hate. Appreciate that.
Love
okay.
You.
We are honored to have Hank. He's in the booth, but I see him. He is on the. He's supposed to be on this side of the mic, but he's on a mic, and that's all that counts. He told two great stories at the Wimberley Festival, and I responded, and the rest of the audience really loved, I could tell. Hank, did you have a good time on our out-of-town adventure?
I had a blast. I really did, but I'm never coming in at night again. You know, the country always scares me. I don't know if I have to share this with you. You know, there aren't a lot of lights. You know, cops wear mirrored sunglasses at night. A lot of people don't have teeth. And, you know, and even my GTS doesn't work in the country. Somehow it says, "Let's scare the hell out of Hank because he doesn't like being here. So let's tell him to kind of drive into a mountain, turn left here." And that's what happens to me. But I had a ball and the people were terrific. And Harwood, you orchestrated just a beautiful thing. I had a blast. It was a lot of fun. And I just hope we can do it year in and year out.
We will. I want to be clear. I did not orchestrate that. There was a whole host of team of people. But I was one of of an army of really dedicated, talented people.
Well, it was great.
The thing that really, I think the most heartening thing to me was there was a lady who made coffee all day. Mm-hmm. Like if there was a moment when you needed coffee, there was someone who cared enough to have that coffee ready for me to have. And I really appreciate it. I want to shout out to the coffee lady.
Right.
And also the lady that wrote everybody's name on a lanyard in beautiful calligraphy. That made me feel so special.
It really was. And then it was handwritten.
It was hand calligraphy.
It was,
that really made my heart just break. Somebody cared.
And also paper towels in the men's room.
Paper towels are important.
Because you know how these events go. By the afternoon, there's no paper towels. You know that.
I felt very taken care of. Yeah, I was taken
too.
Care of.
Great so, vegan work. Sandwiches. Anyway, there were so many good
aspects.
There
were some good aspects to this thing. So let me do this. Hank, I want to hear the story. One of the ones, is it one that you told or that you're going to tell tonight?
Yes, it is.
Okay,
it is.
Bring that on. Let's go back. We're throwing back on Thursday to the Wimberley Storytelling Festival.
Well, this is a story that I've told on the air before, but it's a very important one to me. It's about my grandfather. And, you know, Some claim to have witnessed souls leaving the bodies of those who just passed. There are a lot of cases that have been documented by hospice nurses, doctors, faith-driven family members. And I was always a skeptic until I watched my grandfather's soul leave his body. My dad left when I was 14. He wasn't a bad man, but he was sick and he was weak. But I had my grandfather, who, along with my grandmother, mother and brother, lived together in a small house. Actually, it was the original tiny house, maybe a little bit larger. My grandmother ruled the nest. She reigned supreme as the chief petty officer at the house. And my grandfather, he was always a very quiet man. He was always the model of humanity. He never said a bad word about anyone, never. And after 3 years at Dachau concentration camp, observing hundreds of atrocities, I always thought that he had reason to hate just about everyone. But no, never a bad word, even for those who may have deserved it. And that's when he used words, because he was a man of very few. For example, every day he used to bring home a bag of M&Ms for me, and I would simply, and he would simply walk over my head, because I'd be laying on the floor watching Leave It to Beaver at 4:30 in the afternoon, and he would shake a bag of M&Ms over my head just to let me know that he didn't forget me. I was 14, walking down the street after stealing a cigarette from my mother, and I'm walking literally in a snowstorm, and up in front of me comes my grandfather. He suddenly becomes present in the snowstorm, and I couldn't believe it, of all people. I was stunned by his presence. I looked to him, and all I saw him do was to kind of gesture like, "No, don't you do that," gestured with his finger, and he never ratted on me. He was that kind of a man, just very, very few words. My most cherished memory was a story that he told me every year without fail, starting when I was about 5 years old. The story was is that he had this gold watch while he was in concentration camp. Now, I'm 5 years old, so I really have no idea what he's talking about, but I listen to him because I love him and I care, and I know that he's a man of very few words, so I knew this had to mean something. So the story is he has this gold watch that he kept in his sock while he's in Dachau concentration camp. He was a laborer, so he was able to keep his clothing, and he kept it in his sock so the Nazis wouldn't find it and take it away. He also told me that it was a symbol of hope that he would one day run across my mother and my grandmother, who were separated from him. They were in a concentration camp called Stutthof, and my grandfather was in Dachau. Now, he told me this story year in and year out. In fact, he told me the story 21 times, because a few months after the last telling, when I was 26, he was diagnosed with leukemia. We were all optimistic because a lot of older people survive certain types of leukemia, but it was not to be. I was in the hospital room the last day of his life. It was around 8 p.m., and I found myself and my grandfather alone in his room, really smothered in silence. And as I looked at my grandpa lying there, I saw him turn cold with a soft blue hue, and then white, almost abruptly. I knew what just happened. But I walked over to him and I placed my hand over his face, kind of hovering above it, whispering, "Grandpa, Grandpa," hoping to feel or to hear some sign of life. And then I felt a chill just before my body jerked to the left, and I saw in the corner of my left eye an aura, a visible steam-like substance, not unlike what we see coming from a tea kettle. And then it disappeared. A few days later, at my grandfather's funeral, a good friend of the family came up to me and handed me a small box, cotton-laced, and in it was that watch, the one that he told me 21 times. It's a watch I never even knew he had, but had heard about for over two decades. And under the watch, there was a small piece of scrap paper that read, "I love you," not even signed. And that was typically him, because he was a man of very few words, no words wasted. Everything had to mean something. Everything. Everything that my grandfather did was really fueled by gentleness, and kindness. And when I think about him, I think of things that are only good, and I guess that's why I tell so many stories about him. My grandmother was a magnificent human being. She was the one who really taught me about storytelling. But my grandfather was the one who taught me about the power of human dignity and the beauty of love and friendship. He was so loyal and so caring. And I think that's why it hurt so much when I saw his soul leave.
Beautiful, Hank. That was just amazing. I know your family is so important to you, and I mean, there many things come to mind of why I would tell that, but is there anything you'd like to add to why you shared that particular story with us?
You know, I appreciate that question, Harwood. I've always been a skeptic when it comes to, you know, the metaphysical world. You know, hey, I saw the soul leave the body. Yeah, right. Okay, good. Yeah. I saw a ghost coming out of a house. Uh-huh. Nice. Yeah. You know, I've always been a skeptic, and I'm not anymore. And I'm not trying to convince people to believe that souls exist, but maybe I am trying to get individuals who have always been or still are as skeptical as I always was, that the world is filled with magical things. And I guess the reason I love telling about this in story form, you know, you and Chris and everybody knows this, is that I find storytelling to be such a magical discovery in terms of human expression. So when I take something like that, like my grandfather's soul, that I never really thought I'd ever see, and I put it in story form, it's like a flawless formula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. Thank you so much.
I appreciate that. I do.
Hank, what's his name so we can remember him?
Jake. He went by Jake. His name was Jacob.
Jacob. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah, he went by Jake. Thanks for asking that. Yeah.
That'll be good to remember.
Yeah.
Him.
That one real very, very quick story. One very quick story to share about.
Sure.
To talk about the difference between my grandmother and my grandfather, who were married for 72 years, for God's sakes. Okay. God. So.
Wow.
And, near the end of his life, not that day, but near the end of his life, he was ill, and it was just a riot that my grandmother is saying to him, Yankel, which was his name in Yiddish, I'm really sorry if I ever yelled at you. I'm sorry if I did this, and I'm so sorry if I told you to do something that you didn't want to do. I'm so sorry. And he looks at her very gently and says, to tell you the truth, I didn't listen to anything. Don't worry about it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's just
gentle, sweet granddad.
It just cracked me up. It cracked me up. And obviously, he didn't mean it literally, although you could tell in a spark of his eye, he kind of looked at me and winked like, I really didn't listen that much. You can't listen. It was sort of his way of saying, that's what you have to do to circumvent conflict, you know.
I'm remembering that out. That's a clever one.
Yeah.
I'll be like, yeah, it didn't bother me. I wasn't listening.
Right, right.
That's cute.
I didn't tell you the truth. To tell you the truth, I didn't listen. You know, just
I'm going to use that.
Yeah, thank you.
Great anecdote. Great anecdote.
I think that's actually a useful tip, too. So, good one.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Hank. That's something to think about, you know? You just never know what's possible in this world. Like you said, there's wonders we haven't dreamed of.
Yeah, and I don't want to have to hog the show, but you remember I know that you were there, Harwood. I don't know if Chris was there when I was talking about my friend Mike, you know?
Yes,
yeah.
I love that story.
And, you know, I've gotten into those kinds of stories lately, and I think in part is I don't feel old, but I'm getting older. And I never really thought about generating stories about people that I love who aren't with me any longer. You don't think about that.
Mm.
But stories are ways of keeping with you. And look, it's not a profound thought, but it makes people immortal.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
It makes them immortal.
It really does. And that's why everybody's been writing stories since the beginning of time, just for remembrance, you know, so you
that's
can remember
right.
things. So
that's right.
Makes
so
good sense, Hank.
Beautiful
Thank
thing.
You.
Thank you.
Well, let me just remind everybody, this is 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. And if you're in Huntsville, it's 91.9 if you're listening. So what's your story? This is what we're here for. This recap of the Wimberley Storytelling Festival might have you packing the car for a weekend in Wimberley, which I encourage because it was a great getaway. Or you might be excited to hear more stories here in H-Town. Hey, Justin, can you fill us in on opportunities to listen to stories here in our town, H-Town? Get down.
So Houston has become a storytelling hub because there's so many options for everybody. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The guild hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, and that is located at 1500 Sunset, and it is directly across from Rice University. It is a great place to develop your love for story. So more information about the guild's events, like their annual Liars Contest on Saturday, April 4th, go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, why not become a member? You can do it conveniently online. Don't leave their webpage before clicking on Radio Program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of our shows since 2008. So What's Your Story was the first storytelling scene in Houston, and it is the seed that helped grow our storytelling community. So please enjoy our past programs and continue to tune in every week for live stories that connect us to each other. No radio, no problem, because you can catch us online anywhere on the globe at www.kpft.org. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And if you have program ideas, questions about storytelling, guests for our guest storytellers, or tell us why you'd become a great guest, drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. If you want to take your storytelling interests to the next level, the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network are waiting for you to become a member. Check them out online. Our friends at The Moth hold their annual monthly swap on the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. The next one is March 10th, and the theme is challenges. Get tickets online because they sell out fast. It is another great place to listen to terrific stories. And I believe, Hank, you wanted something to say?
Yes, I wanted to talk about the Liars Contest, and this is the truth. Okay.
We can't believe you.
Okay. The Liars Contest is a tremendous event. It really is. And Justin just said it's April 4th, and it is. It's at Rudy's on Montrose. All the necessary information is at the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. This time there will be cash prizes. I can't give you an amount on KPFT, but you know, the top prize will have three digits, and I'm not talking above 25. You know, a few years back I won third place in the Liars Contest. Okay, there were three tellers, but nevertheless, it was a lot of fun. If you are interested in being a contestant, you can. Again, all the information is online. We take the first eight contestants. It's an 8-minute story. You get 1 minute grace period, so it's a 9-minute story, and it is a blast. So we hope to see you there, and thanks.
Cool. Thank you so much, Hank and Justin, and welcome back to our Wimberley Rewind. We just want to give a shout out to our new friends at the Wimberley Valley Arts and Cultural Alliance. They are dedicated to the arts community, and we're gracious hosts, especially Kathy and Robert and their dog Hank. They were just wonderful for me and Chris. If you're visiting or have friends who live in that area, definitely follow them on Facebook to learn about other fun arts events. We are so grateful to have Michael Galco in the studio with us tonight. Michael is a geneticist and has a lab at MD Anderson. He's also a poet and an amazing storyteller who really held the crowd, including me and Chris, at the festival in the palm of his hand. Michael, what was your favorite thing about the festival or your trip to Wimberley?
Well, I loved Wimberley. I like the hills there and the river. It was very nice. I also enjoyed meeting all the other folks who organized it. But I think my favorite thing was the indigenous storytellers that they invited, and listening to their stories from the native tradition.
So moving.
Chris kind of said it earlier. I think as humans, we've told stories for, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It's just a way that we communicate. And that listening to their stories really, really drove that home.
Mm. Beautiful. Yeah. Well, the possum story, was it the possum's mm-hmm. tale? Oh my gosh, that was so wonderful. And then the little boy and his talking about his mom's, the experience of being an Indian and the racism they encountered. Yeah. I mean, it was gut-wrenching. I did not know it was going to be that heart-rending it was kind of an exhausting day in the sense that every single story was heartfelt and you know, some were very funny and so forth, but those stories were, I'll never forget them. Thanks for reminding me of that. And you told a story. You told a couple of stories. Will you tell us one tonight that you told?
I will, yeah. So I'll share this story with you. So this is a story that's set about 10 or 12 years ago, shortly after I had moved to Houston to set up my laboratory at MD Anderson. And it's really a story about feeling trapped. So at that time, I was not a very healthy adult human, and I felt a bit trapped by my job, which was a demanding job. I felt trapped by this kind of very large house that my wife and I had purchased in Houston, and we had not fully furnished or anything like that. I felt a little bit trapped by my role as a young parent and not being able to fulfill that. And I also felt trapped in a marriage that was not particularly healthy. So there was a lot going on. And I think like a lot of relatively young men, I didn't deal with that well. So all of that stress. And at the time, I drank a lot and I became basically, I think, what a lot of people would call a high-functioning alcoholic, which basically means that you're able to perform your job and you're able to perform your kind of family duties at some level, but you're really good at hiding the fact that you drink a lot. So, you know, because my marriage was a little stressed and my wife and I at the time, we had very different kind of circadian rhythms. So she would work late into the evening and I usually would go to bed early after having a few drinks and then get up early and work. And so I did this on one day. I had drunk quite a bit the night before, went to bed early, got up early to do some work before my children rose to go to school. And one of the first things I would usually do when I did that was I opened the front door, and the door of this house, kind of McMansion-like house here in Houston, had this large foyer and a little overhang there, and I opened the door to get the morning newspaper to take a peek at it before I started working, and this creature flew by my head and into the house. And I looked up, and there was a light on kind of behind in the distance, and it was a bat. And I could see it flitting and flying around the foyer and thing, and then it disappeared upstairs. And I thought, oh, there's a bat in the house. I didn't think very much of it. So I went to the kitchen table and I started working. And I worked for, you know, an hour and a half. And then my wife got up and we were fixing breakfast for our daughters. And I said, you know, a funny thing happened when I opened the door this morning. A bat flew into the house. And her face went really ashen. And she said, really, a bat? That's terrible. And I said, well, why is it terrible? And she said, because bats carry rabies, she said. And my wife, this was one of the kind of the somewhat stressful parts of the marriage. She did have a way of kind of catastrophizing certain things. So with the bat, this kind of escalated quickly, and she sort of said, you know, bats carry rabies and they hide in the house and they can live a long time and we're going to have to move out and we all have to get rabies shots, and so I'll take the girls into school, you call animal control, you book a hotel, I'll work on getting us rabies shots. And I said, gosh, this seems like a really lot of an effort for a bat, why don't we just ignore it? And she said, because, you know, it could come at us in the sleep and just brush the girl's neck and nick them, and then they would have rabies 2 weeks later and we wouldn't know. And then, you know, so I said, okay. So she took the girls into school. Now, one of the things when you're a high-functioning alcoholic and you all of a sudden have a day spreading itself before you that's kind of open, you think, you know, maybe I can start drinking a little bit earlier today, right? And I have some of these things to do. So anyway, I procrastinated for a bit. I went out to the hardware store and I got a net, and I thought I would find the bat, and I looked all over the house and I couldn't find it. And then finally, late morning, I decided to call animal control, and I called animal control and I said, hey, I have a bat in my house. Could you come get it? And they said, you really don't know how animal control works, do you? And I said, no, I don't. And they said, you have to catch the bat. Well, if you have it, we'll come and pick it up, right? Or if the bat is dead, we'll take it from you. I said, well, I haven't caught the bat yet. I'm not sure where it is. Who else could help me? And they said, you could call an exterminator, or you could, I guess, call the police, although it's not really an emergency, right? So I thought about it, and I thought, I don't really want to call an exterminator. It might cost a lot of money. And, you know, so I thought, you know what, I'll call the police. So I called the police. I called 911. And the first thing I said was, this is not an emergency. I said, there's a bat in my house. It flew in this morning. And, you know, my wife and I are very concerned about it. And we'd like to catch this bat. And the dispatcher said, yes, you're correct. That's not an emergency. And she said, she said something very interesting. She said, I think I have the right guys for you. She said, just hold on. In a couple hours, I'll send these guys out to check on you, right? And see if you can find the bat in the meantime. So I hung up and I thought, okay, this is going to happen. And I was procrastinating. I thought, I'm not going to book a hotel yet. I'll see what happens with this situation. A little after lunch, I started, mixing myself a drink, still working a bit. And a couple hours later, the doorbell rings. And at this point, I'm a bit buzzed. So I've been kind of working for a bit. And these two policemen show up. And they were an interesting duo. So there was one very large man who was an African-American guy. And he never said a word. He was large and young. He had something in his mouth that was either like a ball bearing or a bullet. And he was clicking it in his mouth. And kind of nodding his head very quickly, but he never said a word. The other one was a young gentleman who was clearly from like a Texas farm, maybe that you would find kind of around Wimberley. A young guy, and he said, "You're the guy with the bat, right?" I said, "Yeah, there's a bat in the house." And he said, "Where's the bat?" I said, "I don't know. That's why I called you guys. I thought maybe you could help me find the bat." I said. And the other guy, he's saying this. The other guy's there, click, 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 on this ball bearing. And I said, I don't know where the bat is. He said, well, if you want to find a bat, you got to think like a bat. I said, okay. How do you do that? He said, you got to find a place that's dark and where it might like to hang. He says, like right over there. And right next to the entrance, there was this room that we had that was largely unfurnished. There was this big couch, and it had an arm that had an overhang. And he pointed to it. There was a creature hanging from the arm of this sofa.
Amazing.
He said, it's right over there. And then he said, but I got to tell you, I grew up on a farm, and that ain't a bat. And I said, well, what is it? It looks like a bat. It's hanging kind of down there. He said, I have no idea what it is, but it ain't a bat. It ain't hanging like a bat. It's kind of a little crooked. And so I said, well, what should we do? And he said, well, let's go figure out what it is. So he goes over there and he kind of prods at it with the little net that I had. And all of a sudden, this creature is flying all over the room. And the other guy's going, click, 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 click. And I thought he was going to pull his gun and shoot it in the room. And this creature's flying all over. We're all kind of ducking. And finally, the creature lands on the window at the front of the room. And we all kind of tiptoe over towards it, right? And I should say, an element of this story is I was a bit freaked out and paranoid here because I had several policemen visiting my house, and I was probably visibly drunk, right? So there was a certain paranoia to me in this whole thing. And we tiptoed over to the bat, and we looked closely at it on the window, and the young policeman was correct. It was not a bat. It was a giant moth, right? And I was incredibly relieved at this point for a reason that probably won't occur to most storytellers. I was relieved because I didn't have to do the rest of the stuff. I didn't have to get a rabies shot. I didn't have to book a hotel because moths don't carry rabies, right? So we opened the window there and kind of prodded the moth a little bit, and it flew out into the yard. And this is where I guess the story changes tone a little bit. As you could probably guess from this, I mean, it's a slightly humorous story, but I was a pretty ill young man at that point. I didn't take care of myself, and I didn't do very well by the people around me, and I knew that, and I was kind of ashamed of this whole thing, and as I saw this kind of beautiful creature rise out into the yard and kind of free itself from its own entrapment, I really, and as I was thanking the policeman, I really kind of made this resolve to myself to try to do better and get better and get healthy. I said, you know, if that creature can leave into the greater world, hopefully I can get out of all of this. And I did. I did spend some years getting much better.
That's beautiful.
That's the story.
That's such a moving story.
Really,
I love
is.
It when it's a personal narrative that's serious and ultimately hopeful, because oftentimes I forget that things can change, that I can change. You know, I always think if I'm wrong, then I'll always be wrong. So it just is a good story to remind you that life isn't static, because you can talk about this situation where you felt trapped and how you're not trapped anymore. Because mm-hmm. oftentimes when you're in a situation like that, it seems unchangeable. There's nothing you can
it
do.
It does, yeah.
But it's a good reminder that change is possible and that people can change and situations can change. So thanks, Michael. I like that one. I often feel that way. You know, if I'm wrong, I'll always be wrong. But I don't know if that's always the case, you know. Whew, that's a moving one. Plus, it's just funny. It's a huge... It's right over there. He knew where it was.
You had the right bat patrol.
You had the bat patrol.
They were the right men for the job. The dispatcher was exactly correct.
Well, if you're going to call the cops on a moth, you better hope they send those guys, right? Okay? So, anyway... We kind of in a wrap-up format, we kind of want to mention the other two Houston storytellers that joined us in Wimberley, because we miss them tonight. They're not here.
We did.
But they're otherwise engaged. They have vibrant, busy lives. We do too, but we all corralled ourselves here. But they're out of town or out on the town. It's Sneha Desai and Jackie Ford. Their stories were very entertaining. I enjoyed them, and I had fun hanging out with both of them, which I hadn't really done before. That's one thing that Harwood and I really love about storytelling. You get to hang out with storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fun because, honestly, I don't think there's any one of them that's not super interesting, and if not likable. Or both. They could be both. So Jackie had told a moving story about her mom at the festival that I hadn't heard before. It was a lot. It was really well told and well written, I thought. I enjoyed that one a lot. It was very sensitive to her mother. I always tell stories about my mom, and I don't feel like I tell them in a very sensitive way. So it was nice to see someone else maybe outdo me in that regard. So I would encourage you, if you want to hear some really great stories by someone who's super smart, look for Jackie Ford. She has a bunch of stories on YouTube, which I wasn't even aware of until I investigated. So now I can listen to all of them.
Have you been stalking Jackie Ford?
I did briefly for a small time this morning. Don't call the cops on me. I'm not a bat or a
stalker.
Moth, okay? So I would encourage you to look them up if you want to hear a good story. And also Sneha, who I got to hang out with, and her husband Sid, who are dope people. She told her favorite story that I love so much, the one about how she became a dog mom because she hated dogs. There was no way in heck she was ever going to have a dog. And now she is dog mom to Coda the Canine Yoda, who is Instagram famous. You need to look him up. He is a unique creature. He looks like he could maybe be a bat or a moth, if we're going to stay on topic.
Yeah, his ears had that kind of wing-like quality.
They are wingish, yes. And she dresses him up in every manner of garb. You want to check this out, especially in a seasonal way, Christmas, a holiday.
Halloween. July 4th.
President's
Day.
He's got an outfit. So check out Coda on Facebook and Instagram if you need a daily dose of cute or awe or eye bleach, whatever you need, get Coda. We miss both of them tonight, and we want to hang out with them again soon, hopefully at another Year 2 Wimberley Storytelling Festival. We're just going to bring it right back to that. And, I did want to touch on what Michael said about the indigenous stories. these are not stories that we tell and that we shouldn't tell. These are not the stories that are from our history, but it was really great to hear, like my personal history. I couldn't tell a story like that because I don't have that background, I don't think. But I really, really enjoyed meeting the indigenous tellers that were there. They were really neat people, just mm-hmm. in general. I even feel like I may have made like a few personal friends. Yeah, mm-hmm. they were just really open and ready to share who they were with you, I felt. It was, you know, nice to hear a story that wasn't a personal narrative, because that's all we talk about is ourselves all day long. I do like hearing about what storytellers have to say about themselves, but if you're talking about a whole tribe of people, it seems like it's something larger than that, you know? So two of the ones we really enjoyed were Amy Blumel and Tim Tingle. You can look them up, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. And they also included in the storytelling festival local people who they picked out from Wimberley who had never told a story before. Harwood, do you want to touch on that? Because we talked to some of those people.
Yeah, absolutely. Those guys that came in from the Wimberley area, so they were not really storytellers per se. They were just asked, they wanted to have the community embrace the storytelling festival by telling stories. And they were terrific. I got to kind of know a couple of them, just not really coaching as much as just encouraging, because once I heard the stories that they wanted to tell, I realized they were just great stories. They didn't need any coaching at all. So I don't know, Chris, if you have 4 minutes to, we have 4 minutes left to tell a very speedy story.
I can tell it real fast. I talk really fast.
Okay. But anyway, just in closing, a very warm gratitude for all the people that had the courage to tell a story, to stand on stage and tell a story. It can be a very scary thing, and they did great.
Okay, well, if I don't get to finish this, apologies. But, okay, when I was a little kid, I had a lot of questions, and my parents were trying to raise, like, future college graduates. They'd say, if you have a question, you should look it up. And this was before there was the internet, so that meant books, right? So I chewed my way through the kids' library. I sucked the juice out of the bookmobile, but I didn't have all the answers I needed. And my parents had heard about a really sweet deal at the Salvation Army. You bring a hefty bag, and they just shovel them in like coal, books, 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 and we'd do that every week. We'd come home and dump out the books on the living room floor, and then my parents would go through them like Halloween candy. They'd pull out the ones with the torn wrapper and the razor blade inside, and they'd also pull out the ones that were like the whole candy bars, you know, the books they wanted to keep for themselves, and they left me the rest. And, I mean, I was grateful for the rest. I read all that stuff. I can lifeguard. I don't swim. I read the Boy Scout handbook, and I could be a Boy Scout. I just never had the right equipment. But the books that I really wanted were the books they took away. Those were the adult books, which has a negative connotation, I admit. But when you're 8 years old, adult books just means books they don't think you're old enough to read yet. So I'd sneak into their bedroom where they kept the adult books, and I'd rip the cover off my Bobbsey Twin books, and I'd slide their books inside. So when we were sitting there watching Mutual of Omaha Wild Kingdom, my dad would turn to me and say, hey, how's the Illustrated Life of Ducks coming? And I'd be like, oh, The Exorcist. It's awesome. Well, there was one adult book I was allowed to carry around, and I carried it around and read it through my entire childhood. It was called Dr. Spock's Book of Baby and Child Care. And as an adult, I wondered why that book was so important to me. And I think it was because I knew I was a child, and I knew I needed care, and I knew my mother had never cracked that book. So every once in a while, I'd check my developmental milestones again, and I'd go up to her and give her little tips and pointers from the book. It pissed her off a lot, okay? So I'm 8 years old, and I'm super excited because I'm going to go see the Lipizzaner Stallions. And if you don't know what the Lipizzaner Stallions are, they're like My Pretty Ponies, snotty European cousins. They're real-life horses, white ones that dance. For an over-involved 8-year-old, that's like going to see Elvis at Graceland. And I was also super excited because I had won this war with my mother. I had had it ever since I was born at the grocery store on the baking aisle, frosting in a can. I'm like, hey, could we get frosting in a can? And she'd say, oh, no, we're not the type of people who buy that. And I'd say, we're not the type of people that like to eat delicious things. And she'd be like, no, we make frosting at home because it's free. But I had won the war, and I was to have my birthday cake with the plastic frosting. So it's the day before my birthday. My mother's got the cake ready. It's plastic. It's glorious. And she's like, hey, would you like a piece of cake? And I said, sure, I would. But I didn't tell her I had an incredible stomach ache. Can you not take a Facebook picture of me while I'm telling a story? Oh, my goodness. I had an incredible stomach ache, okay? And she goes, I knew this was my only chance to, you know, eat the cake and get the frosting, so I didn't mention the stomach ache. And she goes, would you like another piece of cake? And I said, sure I would. By the end of that night, I had eaten half of that cake, and my stomach felt like a telephone book being ripped in half. So I did what I always did. And those of you that have WebMD on your phone, you know what I'm talking about. I looked in the book. And, you know, it wasn't the front of the stomach ache section I looked at. I went straight to the back. Because that last page is always the worst thing you could possibly have. And I went up to my mother and I said, hey, I don't mean to disturb you, but I need to go to the hospital because I have appendicitis. And she just spun around on me with the most disgusting look. She goes, every time you have a migraine, you have meningitis, you have a rash, it's impetigo. Here's a cold washcloth. Just go lay down. Well, the next morning I got up, and I couldn't even stand up straight. And you can't get past the school nurse with that. So my mother knew that she had to take me to the doctor. I walked into the doctor. I'm holding my intestines together, and the doctor turns to my mother and said, hey, when does she last eat? And my mother said, well, aside from half a cake about 8 hours ago, not much. And the doctor said, well, I just need to call ahead and tell the surgeons. And my mother went pale white. Because we didn't have surgery at my house. We had cold washcloth. Okay? So it was a really quiet ride to the hospital. An hour later, they removed an 8-pound cake ball and my appendix. And when I woke up in the morning at the hospital, I was really sad. I knew there was going to be no Lipizzaner Stallions. I had missed it. But all of a sudden, my dad burst in and he says, good morning, Dr. Kildare. What I didn't know was that my dad had told everybody in the hospital complex the story of his 8-year-old who had diagnosed her own illness. He told people in the parking lot. He told people in the elevator. He told people who didn't even care about it. And I didn't know who Dr. Kildare was, but I knew my dad was super proud of me. And my mother, she wasn't there. But I looked down at the edge of my bed, and there was a small, stuffed white horse. And I remember I picked it up, and I held it close to my face. And I knew it was something I didn't have to look up in any book. It was the only apology my mother was going to give me on this matter. And it was soft, and it was just right. That's the story I told about my mother. It wasn't sensitive like Jackie's, but it was that's what it is.
Seriously, that is one of my very favorite stories that you tell, and I absolutely adore it. I love all of your stories. You're my favorite. In fact, when the storytelling festival we had, they wanted me to recommend some, you know, some people. I said, absolutely have to hire Chris and me.
I like the nepotism. It was strong.
So don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Chris Gorman.
And Harwood Taylor.
And along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, that's right, and Hank.
And Hank, and Greg's in the studio, too.
We really appreciate all of you being here and telling your stories. And Floyd, of course.
And Floyd.
And never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Peace.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.